All right. Well, good morning. There you go. I've been switched back to welcome. So there. That's improvement. We just started our new series over the book of Hosea last week. This will be the continuation of that. We'll cover the second and third chapters this morning. As we get ready to angle into that, it might be helpful to understand a little bit about how this book is laid out or formatted or arranged for us. Hosea is a type of book that is put together like some of the other Old Testament books of the Bible and even some of the New Testament books of the Bible, in that the author will start the writing and kind of throw the main point out there at the beginning. He just puts everything out there immediately in chapter one for us. And this is kind of unique because this isn't really what happens in modern writing very much. Modern writing tends to be a whole lot more patient. The author will kind of hold the cards close to the chest for a while, as long as possible, revealing detail after detail as they go, building anticipation, and slowly they'll kind of progress towards this big reveal or this aha moment later on. Well, Hosea doesn't do that at all. There's no slow build with a reveal at the end. Hosea took one verse for introduction, and then just bam, there it is. There's the main point of the entire book. And what Hosea will do after that is he will thoughtfully and intentionally begin to build a picture of how that main idea was given or came to pass. So a way to think of it is chapter one gives us the 30,000 foot view of the book, where you're up high, you can see everything, you can see the main point, you can see the big idea in the book. And then later on, as we move forward after chapter one, Hosea is going to lay the groundwork. You're going to have a zoomed in picture, and it's going to give you the details, and it's going to build the ideas of how in the world this main idea kind of came to be. So the main idea is out there. Now we're going to understand the details that made the main idea possible. To make sure that we can really dig into this book and we're adequately prepared, I'll remind us a little bit of what was revealed last week. If the main idea is already out there, we better understand that main idea. As the book opened, God directed this prophet named Hosea to do something that's probably surprising if you've never read the book of Hosea. He directs this prophet to go marry a whore. There have been many people over time who have tried to tame down that message. Like, that's uncomfortable to me. So surely he didn't do that. So what they do is they try and kind of tippy toe around the text and go, well, Hosea didn't really marry a whore or a prostitute. He actually just married a woman who would be unfaithful to him later. But that idea, understandably, I understand why you'd want to kind of mute that out of the text, because it's weird. That idea directly goes against what God actually said. Furthermore, what would it look like? How would Hosea court a woman? You look like someone who's going to be unfaithful to me one day. Like, so you want to get married? Like, that's probably not the way that it would work. God did not mince words. He was quite clear to Hosea of exactly what he wanted him to do. He told him, I want you to marry a prostitute, a harlot, a practicing whore, and I want you to have children with her. Can we just throw that out there? That's probably the most unusual calling you can hear of. What does God want over my life? To marry a prostitute? That's not what I expected. This question immediately raises other questions, like, why? Why, God? Why in the world would you have this faithful man, this man that you deem worthy to kind of give a message? Why would you have him do that? Why would you have him marry a woman like that, a person like that? Why would you have him destined for unfaithfulness? Why would you do that? And the answer to that question is in the text itself. Hosea, I want you to marry this type of person because the land, the people of God, the church, are committing great whoredom by forsaking God. That's what the text said. Prophets were asked to deliver a message from God, for God, and to the people of God. Right? I want you to go give this message to those people. Right? This is what it was wanted whenever there was a prophet to come. So what was going on is, all of a sudden, God was asking Hosea, the message that I want you to give to these people, I want you to deliver it not just through words, I want you to deliver it through your life. Your life is going to give them a picture of the message that I want to give them. So I want you to marry an unfaithful wife so that my people can see what my relationship with them really, really looks like. They hide behind their Christianese. They hide behind all of these other things to pretend the relationship is good. But I want you to go marry a person like that so it can show them this is what we're really like. My people, Israel, say they're in covenant relationship. They're in a marriage with me as their God. But the reality is that they are going for everything besides me, for their joy, for meaning, for rest, for fulfillment, for protection, for provision. All of those things they're supposed to find in me, but they're going to other places. This biblically is an act of infidelity. This is cheating on God. And furthermore, they're doing this infidelity right under his nose. They're not hiding it at all. And God had had enough. So he wanted them in real life to see what the disgrace of the relationship looks like. Hosea, I want you to go marry a prostitute to show them what our relationship actually is. Ray Orloon says the northern kingdom, Yahweh charges, has become a brothel. It's not a matter of isolated here and there false worshiping. The people have lapsed into egregious violations of their covenant with Yahweh. It's not like they slipped up every once in a while. They're doing it over and over and over and over, and they're not even hiding it. What must be understood, we tried to reveal this last week, is God's people, the northern kingdom, they hadn't left God. They hadn't turned atheistic by any means. They had just become irreligious. The problem was that God had become one of the many things that they worshiped. They didn't stop worshiping God. He was just one of several things. Their worship became kind of like a vending machine sort of arrangement. I'll go to this to get that, and I'll go to this to get that. I'll go to Baal for fertility and prosperity. I'll go to Assyria for protection. I'll go to possessions for peace of mind. I go to all these places to get what I want over my own life. I go to everything but God to try and make my life work well in the way that I want. They had stopped looking to God for protection, and they stopped looking to God for meaning or anything like that. Now, this is the way in which their faithfulness had begun to play itself out. The people of God weren't being the people of God. They weren't acting like the people of God. Something needed to change. And we heard at the end of chapter 1 that the covenant, the marriage between God and his people was dangerously close to ending. It was extremely close to divorce, to God understandably walking away, an action that he had cause for. His wife, his people, had broken the covenant, but instead of walking away or moving away, God instead promises to stay near, and he leans into the relationship. He promises to give them mercy through the Lord, which is a reference to Jesus coming one day. And to miraculously declare over the sinful, cheating people that they are clean and they are his and they are secure. As we begin reading today, what we're going to understand is just how bad the relationship was. We're going to see the details of how far gone it was and what Hosea did in the face of that. And I would like to lay this question before you before we dive into the text to try and get our minds to begin just thinking about this text. And I'll warn you, when I give you this question, your urge will probably be the same as mine. Your urge is going to be really to not think about the question, but to regurgitate the right answer. Right, you know when there's a question and you know what you should answer and you just automatically you throw it out there without even thinking about that? That's probably going to be your propensity to this. But I hope that you would avoid that and that you'd think about it this morning and this week. And hopefully you'd even talk about it in your MCs later this week. But the question is this, and let it sit. Let maybe even the Spirit of God minister to you through this question as he has just margin to speak to you. Here it is. Does sin matter? To the church, to us, does sin matter? Not in the world, not out there. Does your sin and my sin, does that personal sin, does it actually matter? Is it a big deal? You see, the Bible is full of descriptions of salvation in a very legal way. There's a lot of court sounding words that come around the idea of salvation. Sin is a violation of God's holy law. One day there will be a judgment over all of that sin. If there is a law and a judgment, there's also a court case. So there's going to be evidence that is really manufactured through our lives, and it's going to be examined and weighed against the holy law of God. And when that happens, a guilty verdict will be clearly warranted for all the violations that you and I have committed. That's the reality. There is a law and there are lawbreakers, which I am one of, and so are you. And in that spot, we would be declared guilty because of that. But God himself has intervened. The sentence God's people deserve for themselves has already been carried out on Jesus on the cross. This is why we like the name at Redemption's Hill. This is where the sentence was carried out. Jesus has borne the penalty of our sin, and the verdict on our lives that we deserve, we don't get. It's taken by him. The verdict that should be given to his life because of his perfection is then given to us. He bears the judgment for our disobedience, and we enjoy the rewards of his obedience. This is the terminology around atonement. Christ has paid for you and your penalty, and you get the reward of his righteousness because of it. Now, if this is true, if God's justice is 100% satisfied by Jesus on the cross, if your past and your present and your future sins are already fully paid for in Jesus, if all of that is true, if it's paid for because your faith is in Jesus Christ for the problem of your sin as your Redeemer, then if that's truly the case, then does sin matter? Does it really cause any damage? If it's already been paid for, if it's already been wiped away, then is it really that big of a deal if we commit, you know, another 1, 2, or 3,000 of them? Or is it kind of like an all-inclusive resort? Right? The tab is paid, so drink the watered-down drinks, right? The tab is paid, so eat the food. The bill's already paid, so we're just going to partake over and over and over to make sure that we take full advantage of the bill. Is that the way that sin should be looked at? It's already paid for, so go for it. See, if the financial and penal costs of our sin have already been paid, then it raises a very interesting question that we have to answer. Then how should we look at sin? What do we do with it? Is it a big deal? Is it a minor deal? Is it a small offense? Is it a big offense? And again, I'd urge you this morning to let that question sit and ask yourself, what do you think of that? Do you think your sin matters? And does your lifestyle agree with the answer that you would give? We'll come back to that question later. Hosea 2, verses 2 through 3. Plead with your mother, plead, it says, for she is not my wife and I am not her husband, that she may put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day that she was born, and make her like a wilderness and make her like a parched land and kill her with thirst. As chapter 2 opens up, we get into the middle of the details. And you'll notice quickly, we are in the middle of a very hairy situation. It is bad. It is really bad. Hosea and Gomer are no longer on speaking terms, right? And it's kind of like the Boys to Men song, Water Runs Dry. We don't even talk anymore, but they know what they argue about. If you're older, you know that song. It was good, right? They argue about Gomer's unfaithfulness. But they can't even talk at this point. So Hosea has to do this. I can't give her a message, so I have to give it to my kids to give to her. She won't listen to me anymore. She has grown deaf to her husband's voice. She has too many other things that have captured her heart that she won't listen to him. And even when she hears his voice, she doesn't really care. I'll lay this out as clearly as possible. If you want to know if you could be Gomer, if you could be a person who's caught up with too many things, unfaithful to God, with too many things that have your worship, if you are searching for other lovers in life besides God, then ask the simple and humbling question, do you hear God speak anymore? Do you slow down enough to let him work in your heart even now? Or is the noise from all the stuff that you do, that we just call life, has that drowned out God's voice? Since they aren't on speaking terms, Hosea has to have the kids give the message. So it's starting out at the very beginning with just a heartfelt pleading from his heart to his wife. Gomer, I'm pleading with you. You aren't acting like my wife anymore, and this is killing me. You're not acting like I'm your husband either. So he pleads, put away the whoring from your face and your adultery from your breasts. This is a reference to the opened and blatant running to other relationships. She's not hiding it. It's opened. Gomer was dressing like a whore, scantily clad, letting it all hang out for the boys, adorning herself in a way that left nothing for the imagination. And she would flirt and she would strut her bad stuff as she walked down the city streets, begging for the eyes of men to take notice of her. It was intentional. Hosea is saying, Gomer, I love you. We don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to have it all figured out either. But please stop this madness. Slow down. You don't have to be perfect, but you have to stop that reckless pursuit of other things. The plea from the heart also comes with a warning. Stop this provocative stuff, or else I'm going to take it to the extreme. just talked to somebody earlier this morning. I said, I read chapter 2 and was like, whoa, yeah, there's some interesting stuff that happens. He goes, all right, I plead with you to come back because I love you. If you don't stop, we're gonna keep walking down this road. You like to walk around practically naked for men? Well, I'll keep it going. I'll take everything that you have, and this little game of yours will be maxed out as you are left with absolutely nothing naked in the streets. He's meaning you're not going to have anything left. We're going to explain what he means by this, but he had been supporting her in a way that she had no idea, and he goes, I'm going to cut it off. You're not going to be able to do that anymore. Gomer, through her worship of the balls and her sexual escapades, had opened up her chances to get more. She thought, if I do all this stuff, I have this ability to be happier, to get more, to do more. And Hosea warns her that stuff, it's going to do the opposite. You think it promises you the world, but it's going to get the world taken away from you. Please quit. Please quit. Verses 4-5 go further. Upon her children also I will have no mercy, because they are children of whoredom. For their mother has played the whore. She has conceived them and has acted shamefully. For she said, and hear this, I will go after my lovers who will give me bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Verse 5 is critical to understanding chapter 2. It's the crux of Gomer's mentality. Gomer had started to go to other things, to other lovers, to get what she needed and wanted. I go to this to get this. I go to this to get this. But she not only enjoyed going to other lovers, she enjoyed the amenities that her whoredom was bringing her. And what is so scary about this, what is so crazy about this, is there's no indication anywhere that the things that she was going to other lovers for, that Hosea wasn't giving her already. Hear the text. I'm going to them for bread and water and wool and flax and oil and drink. Just, I mean, that's regular stuff. These are things that Hosea was already providing for her. It's like saying, well, I'm going to cheat on my husband to get food, but her husband already fed her. This means that Gomer got to the place where she just rathered get these things from other places. It's not that you can't give them to me. It's that I'd rather get them from that person. From other sources, and this is heartbreaking. It's also modeled in the way that Israel was living back then. See, they had started going to other gods, worshiping them, loving them, pleading that they'd give them things that God had already given them. Where did they get the excess to worship these other gods from? From the God of the Bible. And they would take that excess and worship Baal instead. It's not that you aren't supporting me, it's that I would just rather get this somewhere else. In order to try and acquire and secure the things that God was already giving them, they were going to other places. They rather depend on and lean on some fake little doll carved out of wood instead of depending on the God of the Bible who'd already cared for them, loved them, and giving them so much that they already needed. What we have to understand is this text isn't meant to be devoid of our life. This same scenario can play itself out in our lives if we don't pay attention. It looks like when you and I run to other things for rest too often. This is one that I've wrestled with greatly over the last bit. When we run to other things to refill our hearts and souls over and over and over, when God has said, I want to do that for you. And I've proved that I will do that for you, but yet you've just stopped coming to me to get that. It happens when you and I go to other things in the world to define our worth as people. When God says you are made in the image of me, and I sent my son for you furthermore. You have great value already. God has already put a value over our head that's greater than anything else will ever give us. But we go to other places for our value as well. Our rest and our value, we go to other places when God has given them to us already. What puts this over the top is the gravity of Gomer's unfaithfulness, though. Most prostitutes back then allowed themselves to be approached or called by lovers or callers. Right? They dressed their way. Said, you know what I am, right? And the customers would come after them. But the text says that Gomer is visibly running after customers trying to court them. This is to show how far gone she is. She's running with reckless abandon after other lovers. She is really, really far gone. So is Israel back then. And so might be some of us this morning. Hosea 2 verses 6-9. We're going to hear more about this idea of kind of being cut off. Therefore, I'll hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build up a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain and the wine and the oil, and who lavished her with silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take back my grain in its time and my wine in its season, and I will take away the wool and the flax, which were to cover her nakedness. Gomer does what we do. She had forgotten where her blessings had come from. She had received so many blessings from her husband, Hosea. Just like Israel was not remembering all the blessings that they had and being delivered by the hand of God and being given so much by God, possibly like some of us don't remember the beauty of what God has brought us and the peace and mercy that he's given us. So Hosea decides that he loves Gomer too much to let her keep going. Something's got to change. I can't just keep going this way. So it appears that not only had Hosea provided for her earlier, but now while she's shacking up with another person, she is literally living with, staying with another man. Hosea is bringing to this other guy that is shacking up with his wife grain, wine, and oil for Gomer. She had no clue. She's making a mockery of the marriage. She's making a mockery out of her husband. And the husband, Hosea, the whole time had just been bringing this stuff to the other guy going, just make sure she's taken care of. I can't see her without. Just take care of her. Are you hearing the level of love and compassion he had towards his wife, even in the face of her unfaithfulness? He still quietly came, gave resources to watch out for her, to care for her. This is mind-blowing. Which of us would do this? In the face of this type of unfaithfulness, that would be hard to do. And Gomer was ignorant about it the whole time. She had no idea. She had no idea that he was bringing it to her and for her. So she used those blessings even more and took them to pursue other lovers with the blessings that her husband was giving her. We've said this before, but this is really what sin does. This is a picture of it in our own life. It blinds us to what God has already given us. So what we end up doing is we pursue the beauty of what God has given us in other places instead. And this is crazy. Let me pursue elsewhere what God is already wanting to give me and has a history of giving me. Let me pursue elsewhere in worldly things imperfectly what God has given me perfectly already in himself and in his love. It's a blindness that we have. It's a forgetting that we have. And Hosea says to all this, fine. I'm not going to let you keep doing what you're doing, though. So I'm not going to provide for you in the middle of your unfaithfulness. I'm removing my blessings. I'm not going to keep bringing you silver and food and other things that you need in hopes that you'll wake up. Now I'm going to stop doing those things and in hopes that when you realize like how much is being taken away from you or how much I've given you that you'll return and go, man, I had so much more back then. His hope is that she'll come back. He even says that the hope is that you'll return to me, but that didn't quite work. He withdraws. He stops giving her what she needs. And what does Gomer do? She doubles down into her sin and chasing of other people. She chases even harder after other lovers. It had the opposite effect. Verses 10 through 15. It says, now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. And no one shall rescue her out of my hand. And I will put an end to all her mirth and her feasts and her new moons and her Sabbaths and all her appointed feasts. And I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are the wages which my lovers have given me. Notice that. She's so confused that she believes that her sin has given her the blessing instead of God. No, I'm cutting that off. I will make them a forest, and the beast of the field shall devour them, and I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. The intent here is to show how Gomer was chasing other lovers with everything she had. sparing no expense, giving all of herself to other efforts, giving every effort to get them. And in doing so, she had been promised joy. She believed going after all these things is going to make life worth living. It's going to make me happy. It's going to make things okay. But in reality, all she was finding was not joy, but misery. The text says that there's a devouring that is happening, going to something for joy, but getting misery and being devoured instead. These things were overtaking her. They promised her the world, but they were taking the world away from her. And verse 13 says, she's all but forgotten her husband, not even thinking about him. Over the rest of chapter 2 and 3, we'll learn just how far the unfaithfulness had taken her. Verse 14 says this, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her vineyards, and I will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as it is the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal or Baal, for I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more, and I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and the war from the land, and I will make you lay down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever, and I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord, I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. And I will sow her for myself in the land. And I will have mercy on no mercy, and I will say to not my people, you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God. So verse 14 through 23, let's just be honest, it's tricky. But we see first in this is how God wants to reconcile the marriage with his people. In the beginning, it starts not with focusing back on Gomer, but focusing on Israel. In the face of all the horrible unfaithfulness, all of their infidelity, God has let them walk out the consequences of their actions by removing blessings, just like Hosea had done from Gomer. And in that, when their blessings are removed, they're back out in the wilderness, which is symbolic for a time when they don't have a home and things for themselves and worldly blessings. There's an idea in the Bible of eternal judgment, and then there's this kind of current judgment. And this is a form of current judgment. It's not necessarily that God brought all these terrible things down upon them. He just sidesteps and goes, hey, you want to do all that stuff? Walk it out. Have fun. Have fun. You want to run after all those other gods? I'm going to stop trying to give you all of this extra stuff because you don't even remember it's me giving it to you. And we're just going to see how that goes for you. You want to do this? Here, I will let you go. And this is what's happening. The intent, just like Gomer and Hosea, is for God to not really crush the people through their hard experiences, but in the hopes that they will, in the wilderness, in a place of struggle, they begin to slow down and listen to him and go, man, I wasn't seeing all the good that he had done. And in this spot, when they had slowed down, the text says the desire is that he would be able to tenderly speak to his people. This is a picture of the grace of God in the face of our blatant sin against him. While we are sinning, while we are running, he lets us walk out the consequences of our actions. And in that place, he doesn't scream, I told you so. He speaks tenderly. And he comes back after us and begins to speak into our ear and tries to woo us back to himself. His hope is to have the people put away their other gods so that they would renew the vows, that they would operate inside the marriage and experience the grace and favor and mercy of God. Despite the people's sin, God's saying, I'm hoping that you can remember all the things that I brought you. And then I'm going to have mercy on those who deserve no mercy. And the people who are acting like not my children, I will call them my children. Another picture of reconciliation. This is what God did over Israel. And let's see in the rest of chapter 3, it's only 5 verses, what Hosea does in his relationship with Gomer. And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man, and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel. There's that connection again. In case you're not seeing it, I want you to love a person who's an adulteress, even as, just like the Lord loves Israel or his children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and they love cakes of raisins. We'll wrestle with that in a second. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a something of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without an ephod or a household gods. Afterwards, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. Notice the connection between fear of the Lord and the goodness of the Lord. Chapter 1 shows us that Hosea was asked by God as a prophet to marry a whore. Now in chapter 3, God says this to him. Go love her in the middle of her whoredom. This is a huge ask. Go marry her. Okay, I did. I tried it and she was unfaithful. Okay, I know. In the middle of her unfaithfulness, I want you to go love her. Love her while she's in love with another man. Love her while another man loves her. Feel the weight of this. Hosea, I want you to go love Gomer when she doesn't love you at all. We have to feel the weight of the text in light of what's happened. It asks Hosea to do the going as well. I want you to be the initiator. I want you to move towards her. I want you to go towards the unfaithful, and I want you to do the work. I want you to do the sacrifice. I want you to do the loving. Even when she doesn't want to be your wife or doesn't want you for a husband, I want you to do it. Now, notice the details. God didn't say, you know, Hosea, I talked to Gomer, and she feels awful. She really does love you. She realizes the error of her ways. You know, I think that you should take her back. That's not at all what the text says. It's more likely that it's Hosea, go love Gomer while she's probably cursing your name. While she is eager to run away from you, ignore you, and entertain other lovers, I want you to love her. In that place, in that context, love her. Go love her. Be the active agent. She's already forgotten you. She's not even trying to speak your name, but I want you to run after her and go love her anyways. She wants nothing to do with you, but go after her. The text says that even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, which is giving us a huge hint to what will come later down the road in the connection of the text. God asked Hosea to love Gomer, just like he's going to ask Jesus to love you and to love me. While we are still sinners, while we didn't want saving, while we didn't want redemption, while we didn't want him to mess with our heart and our lives, he comes and loves us anyway. While we run to stupid lesser things like raisin cakes instead of him, the oddity of this in the text is on purpose. It's showing the just upside down nature of our worship. We will trade the worship of the triune eternal God who gives us all things that we need for a donut, for things that will perish, for a thing that will be gone, for a thing that will satisfy you for maybe 30 minutes and then be gone. We will trade God for that. We run away for him in two meaningless things. In our modern context, there's so many things that we could replace with raisin cakes. Ridiculous hobbies. I think of this at times when I've got like overly infatuated with CrossFit. You're really excited about picking a weight up over your head. Bravo. Perishing. Netflix, social media followings, blogs, job positions, all of it fleeting, and we trade God for it. Just like raisin cakes that they did. Then we hear the gravity of how bad the situation that Gomer had got herself into really was. Something had happened to her. We don't get the exact details of how it happened. But when Chapter 3 opens up. Gomer is being sold like a slave at the auction. Her lovers and her pursuits had led her completely into destitution. They had completely ruined her. And now she would have been stood in front of a crowd of men, naked, for them to see the goods and bid on her. She had been a prostitute already. They were going to have somebody own her and prostitute her out further. They're checking her out, eager to use her, and then throw her away. And catch this, is she is standing there, vulnerable, naked, with nothing, destroyed everything in her life. She is there. It looks like it is all over. Hosea runs in and outbids everyone else and buys her back. Why does he do this? To reconcile the relationship. A price must be paid for Gomer to be set free. Why? Because she'd got herself into such a mess. Understand the gravity of what he did there. The offended offers up the money and the means to free the offender. The one who is cheated on pays money to get the cheater out of a jam. What in all probability probably happened to Gomer at this point is like a drug addict just needing more and more and more. She got herself into debt. She was chasing those lovers and other things and possessions so hard that she had got herself into debt. And now she was basically had a debt over her head and somebody owned her. She needed ransomed. She needed bought out of the problem that her unfaithfulness had caught her. So the innocent one in the marriage paid to free the guilty one that day. Think of the audacity of that. Then Hosea asked Gomer to be faithful, to be a part of rebuilding the relationship, to stop chasing other lovers and give their marriage and their relationship a real shot. Friends, the message and the meaning here is unmistakable. Jesus is the better Hosea. He was sent by God to rescue a people who didn't even want him. He was asked by God to love a people who did not love him. And like Hosea had to pay a price to get Gomer out of the state of her unfaithfulness, Jesus pays a much higher price on the cross, the cost of his blood, which the cost was the cost to free us from the penalty of our sin. See, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He died for the ungodly. Why? So that we may be free. The point of all of this is really to get us to see the living picture so we could sympathize with Hosea in the story. What the story is asking you to do is this. Imagine marrying, as Hosea does, a woman who will be unfaithful to you and abuse your love. Imagine that. You're like, man, okay. Then imagine marrying someone knowing that they'll betray you the whole time. And then they do, time and time and time again. And then being asked, as Hosea is in verse 1 of chapter 3, to forgive her betrayal. And then imagine paying, as Hosea does in verse 2 of chapter 3, to restore her when she still can't stand your name. And then imagine bringing her into your house, as Hosea does, offering her all the amenities of someone who was a faithful member of the house the whole time. Do all this. Love a person who doesn't love you. Forgive a person who betrays you. Pay a debt for a person who has wronged you and offer them a place in your home like they've never done anything wrong the entire time. Do this for a person who's metaphorically spit in your face over and over and over again. Remember, again, there's no indication ever that she is repentant. She didn't send a letter, Hosea, I'm in so much trouble, come get me, I love you, I was so wrong. None of that happened. The reason Hosea came is God said, go love that person. Perhaps Hosea has to love her in the face of hostility, even after the debt is paid and she is welcomed into the house. I imagine that things are tense. See, we are invited in this story to share Hosea's pain, to feel it at a deep level. And then the transition is meant to happen for us. Then we are meant to see that this is actually God's pain. And we were made to make the connection that is unthinkable, and we are actually the Gomers. The way she treated Hosea is the way we treat God. And in spite of that, God's response is like Hosea's towards us. He shows us love. He buys us back at a great, great expense to himself. And then the issue that we often overlook, he restores his presence. See, when God sends Jesus for us to pay the bill that our sin has caused, it's not just, well, I can, you know, you can just be around me. He welcomes us back in as if we never did anything wrong in the first place, as if we were the most cherished family member in the world. He's not holding a grudge. He's not just waiting for us to do wrong again. He welcomes us back in, restores his presence, and welcomes us back into the house as a family member. This is the grace and mercy of God. We can tend to, in our minds, view salvation as really a two-way street. As if we did something to warrant it. You know, like we put the ledger together of pros and cons and decided on God. We started just being really good and God wanted us on his team. Like a number of things we began to believe, but what we're meant to see through the story of Gomer is that you and I did nothing to earn our salvation. All we did is bring the sin to the table necessary to kill Jesus over. That's our part. If you want two-way, that's what you did. You brought this and Jesus brings the love. And then, despite all of that, as that sinful place that we stand, Christ was willing to come and die anyways to pay the price. I asked the question earlier in the message as we opened, does your sin matter? And this is why. I think we could all give the answer, right? Does your sin matter? Yeah. Yeah. Why does your sin matter? Why? Well, sin is not simply breaking God's law. It's not breaking some arbitrary rule. It is breaking the heart of God, the one that we are in a covenant with. The one who loves us more than we know. We're turning on that one. It's important to remember that God doesn't just want a forgiven people. If he wanted that, he could pull us out at any point. But he wants a people for himself, a bride, a relationship with his own, which means our heart needs to be cultivated to be prepared to be in a relationship with him. So salvation is not simply a legal transaction placed over you. Salvation is not just an act of justice to cover your injustices. It is those things, but salvation is an act of love for the people of God in which God loves. So our sin is a constant betrayal of that love, and it wounds the one who loves us. And it matters because God feels that betrayal in the same way that Hosea did. It grieves him. It hurts him. Why? Because he's passionate about his people. He doesn't want just little minions. He wants people to rest and lean into and love him and be in relationship with him. And our sin is an ignoring of that relationship. I hope this morning that you would get a clearer picture of God's love. Man, you guys can come back up. How unthinkable it is that he would do what he did, that he would love us when we are in such dire need, that he loves us while we don't really love him. While we are unfaithful, he comes for us. He loves us and he chases after us. He tears down and breaks apart our hearts of stone and gives us a heart of flesh in their place. I pray for you and I that this type of love would be made real for us. The grace of God that loves undeserving people, that loves the wayward and the lost, that loves the people who are reckless with their lives. He's reckless in his love. See, our hearts need to be overcome with the magnitude of this love that is offered up to us and is available to us. The hard part, the rub for us, is in order to feel the magnitude of the rub, we have to accept the fact that we're the Gomer, and most of the time we don't want to do that. Right? To understand that we have sin and that we have brokenness and we have things that we can't deal with is a spot that's difficult. It causes us to have to lay down our pride, but the beauty of when you do that is that's the only point that you can accept the full scale of God's love for you, how great of a need I had and how willing you were to pay it. My hope and my prayer is that what would continue this morning is that the voice of God would call us back to himself, that some of the ways that we're worshiping other things would be pointed out, and we begin to just lay those down as we see the beauty and the love of God as just better. For some of us that we've walked into things that we shouldn't be in the middle of, that we would be reminded of the blessings that God has already given us, that our eyes would really be open to the beauty of Jesus, and maybe the pursuits of other things just wouldn't look so good and shiny to us, and Jesus would become bigger and bigger and bigger for us, and we begin to worship in light of what he's done. He has come in a desperate, dire state we were in and loved us there. That is the beauty of the gospel. And the rest of our lives ends up being, will you believe in that? Will you rest in that? And is that good enough for you? I pray that the answer would be yes, that we would lean into that this morning. Would you stand and pray with me? God, I pray that you help us to see the beauty of what you've done, God. I know in my own heart it's so difficult to admit fault, especially in places that I don't want to. But I pray that we would see the beauty of what you've pulled us out of. That even though we have faults and we have sins and we have disregard towards you, that you still loved us there. That your desire is to show us the magnitude of that love. I pray that you would do that, God. The idols and the things that we chase, I pray that we will begin to put some of those back in their rightful place. To worship you is good, and maybe lay some of those other things down, God. I pray for that. May we receive joy and mercy in you today. May we understand the beauty and the magnitude of who you are, God. Be glorified in us today. Be made real in our hearts and our minds, God. We love you. I pray this in your name.